Welcome back. Hour number three tonight on this Thursday night. Mike King is back with us tonight. Mike is one of the really, I think, most impressive, accurate, and important historians working on the internet right now. And for years, he's been bringing forth the truth about what really happened in the past, as in World War II, etc., and other things, like very few people ever would even dare. And he's got books, he's got a lot of stuff. If you look under his name and guests, you'll see the first little story I put up. He sent it to me the other day. Hitler's 1936 Olympic Games, like you've never seen them. And I think most of you understand the horror that has been done in terms of corrupting history regarding the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And then also there's another one about Europeans and Trump and so forth. But this whole 1936 Olympics, I think, tells the story in a way as a template in which you should always use in your mind when you approach any Western version of World War II history. It is completely suspect at the very best. Hello, Mike. Welcome back.
Jeff, good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
It has. Great to be back.
Well, we're both incredibly busy. That's for darn sure. If all of you out there want to pull up that 1936 Olympic Games story, I think it'd be important. We might want to walk through that, Mike, just for openers. It's kind of fun.
Sure.
Because it's such a lie. Yeah. It's all been turned into a big lie.
Well, it is, and I've always liked using that one as you know, I mean, it's so hard to influence people who've never been exposed to this type of information or thinking. You need hooks, okay? And I've always thought the 1936 Olympics was an excellent hook for the simple fact that the man in question, Jesse Owens, I mean, because whenever that topic comes up of the 1936 Olympics, automatically we go to the infamous snub. Hitler was so angry that a black man won all these gold medals in Germany, and he stormed out of the stadium, blah, 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 blah. We've all heard that fairy tale. But
never happened, folks. Never happened.
We don't have to rely.
Right.
Well, we don't have to rely on people like me saying that it's not true. The ultimate authority on the subject is Jesse Owens himself, who wrote it in a book. And all his life, it really bothered him that people kept saying it, because the reality was, this is according to Owens, when he passed Hitler stood up and waved at him and gave him respect for his great performance. And then we later learn, and this is independently corroborated by two different sources, that Hitler had his photo taken with Jesse Owens. He went down, had his picture taken, and Owens wanted to finally set the record straight and have the picture published in 1966.
Uh-huh.
He was invited to a 30th anniversary in Berlin of the Games. He pulled it out of his wallet, and he showed it to the German sports writers, and their jaws dropped, but they looked at each other. They said, you know, Herr Owens, we can't do anything with this. And Jesse was so disappointed, you know, because of the political situation. So he sat on this secret his whole life.
What happened to the picture? Do we know, Mike?
We never got to see the picture. I mean, he's no fool. He figured if he just, like, you know, produced it, they'd probably ruin him, you know. So I'm sure his family buried it, and we never got to see the picture. But it's corrupt. There's a British fighter pilot who was also an athlete, and he was there that day in the Olympics, and he corroborated the story many years ago. And then there's a German sports writer that Owens revealed it to. And then in his own book, he says, Hitler never snubbed me. He says, the Chancellor stood up and waved. He didn't mention the photo at that time. But, you know, it's just refuted by the ultimate source itself. And I always think that's a good hook because, you know, it's something that people think that they all know. And if you've got any kind of astute mind at all, you've got to wonder at some point, well, gee, if they lied about the Jesse Owens story, could they have lied about other things? And so that's a good opener. And
almost
indeed
everything,
they did.
For God's sake.
Yeah.
Here's a quote from Jesse Owens, a man who really has been, if you think about it, more abused by Western Zionist history than most others. He said, when I passed near the Chancellor, Hitler, he arose, waved his hand at me, and I waved back at him. Hitler did not snub me. It was FDR who snubbed me. He didn't even send me a telegram. End quote. Unreal.
Yeah. It is.
So
it's amazing.
It's right there.
And they're still making movies about it. There was one done a few years ago.
Yeah, well, who's making the movies? The Zionists are making the movies.
Yeah. Yeah,
we know this. It's all old stuff. Now, there's another one here. If you scroll down on the page that you hopefully are looking at now, look for Helene Mayer. Helene Mayer. She won the silver medal in fencing. Helene was Jewish. And there she is on the stand after accepting her medal. And she's giving the normal World War II era 30s and 40s, German salute. A Jewish woman on the stand with her right arm held up. This is right there. The pictures don't lie.
Right. And she won the medal for the German Olympic team.
Yeah.
So
that's incredible.
It certainly is. But you can see that piece at realnewsandhistory.com. That's my new website, realnewsandhistory.com. And there's an update section, and that's one of the first items listed there. And so some really interesting pictures. And I'm sure you see the one also of the German crowds, you know, mobbing Jesse Owens for autographs. And he was he said he was so moved by the treatment and the welcome and the respect showed to him by the German people. You know, supposedly these horrible racists. And then after the Olympic Games, the official film, the propaganda film, which was done, featured Jesse Owens prominently, okay? Uh-huh. And so that's for internal consumption, all right? So why didn't they just edit that part out? No, instead, it's one of the focal points of the Games, and the Germans showcased that in the official film that they did about the Olympic Games. So there was no animosity at all. I mean, he was treated like a rock star. Yeah.
The sad part of it is how he was treated here by the president and others. They ignored him because there was real racism still here in this country back in the day.
One more thing. This is not in the piece, but this is... something else I'd like to add, later that same year, there's a presidential election. It's 1936. Mm-hmm. And Owens, back then, most blacks were Republicans, okay, or a substantial number, but it was a majority. Owens endorsed the 1936 candidate for president, mm-hmm. okay? And lo and behold, a few years later, he starts having IRS problems. And FDR was known for this. He would go after his enemies using the IRS. So to have somebody of Owens' fame, you know, because you know, they wanted the black vote. They wanted to start taking the black vote away from the Republicans. You know, to have someone in that stature go for the Republican, you know, they had to put the boy in his place. And another one was Joe Lewis, same error, 1936, Joe Lewis endorsed a Republican who ran against FDR. And then in 1940, it was Owens, or perhaps it was both 1936. It's not important. But both of the great star athletes, icons of black America, Joe Lewis and Jesse Owens, endorsed FDR's opponents, and then they both had major problems with the IRS, which is why Lewis was fighting. He was fighting well past his prime, and he got clobbered, and he could have got really hurt fighting Marciano. He was too old to fight Marciano.
Shame.
So,
1936, that was Alf Landon who ran against FDR and had Jesse Owens' support. He lost the vote by, let me see, says here 10 million votes to FDR, And we know now that anything can be rigged, and back in the day it would have been even easier in some respects. But we don't know.
Yeah.
It's all corrupted, all of it. Sad to say. So Jesse Owens is a man we don't want to forget about ever. He really did pay a heavy price for being an honorable, heroic American citizen, a great man. Now, here's another one. Yeah. I really like to see this. Carla DeVries. That's a neat story. She's an American woman. Tell us the story. Now, she's from, I think she was from California or Southern California, something like that. Anyway, so tell
I'm not sure
about
the state,
the story.
But she was an American woman who had was in Berlin to attend the 1936 Olympic Games, tourist. And by the way, and there's so many corroborating witnesses from all different countries, they just marveled at what they saw in 1936, the spirit of the people, the revival of the people, the rebuilding of the country. I mean, this is in writing. People like David Lloyd George, who was a former prime minister of Great Britain, wrote an article in 1936. He says, I can't believe what I saw in Germany. The country is booming. The people are so happy. They're unified. He said, Hitler is the greatest man. They idolize him. He has rescued the country, on and on and on.
And just
many people made this observation, many people. Mm-hmm. But Carla DeVries, she was just an American tourist, and she was there at the stadium. And she said she just had an impulsive moment. She was watching Hitler in the stand, and he just seemed so friendly and kind. She went up to him for an autograph. He was very happy to oblige. And then she plants a kiss on him. And there's film of this. You see Hitler laughing and everybody having a good time. But, you know, it's so sad because this was peak Germany. They had just recovered, and you saw how wonderful everything was. But behind the scenes, the usual suspects were plotting, for war and positioning for war. It was
Keep
already
in mind
inevitable.
That this is the 1936 Olympics. The preceding Olympics were the 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles. That's where the Los Angeles Coliseum came from, the 1932 Olympic Games. From there, it went to Berlin. And that's what we're looking at now, pictures of that.
Yeah.
What an amazing thing that man did. As the one video, I think you've seen it. I think I might have sent it to you. You've probably seen it. The most hated man in the world was also the most loved man in the world. Just depends on where you were standing, which side
of the
Atlantic. Although we got to also remember that up until World War II was forced on America, 80 plus percent of the American people wanted nothing to do with fighting in Europe against Germany at all. Nothing. There were rallies all over the country. So, but these are all lost because history has been completely renovated, as they say. I got to ask you a question. Did you get hassled by the History Channel for the title you used for a while, Real History? You were using that.
The Real History Channel? No, I didn't. And someone has suggested that I might have problems with that, but it turns out that they had changed their name. They were no longer the Real History Channel. They just became History Channel. But no one ever bothered me for that. But I ran into problems with the website when I started heavily promoting a book that I had written on the Holohoax, The Song That Never Ends.
All right.
So,
The Song That Never Ends. Boy, that's got to be worth about $1 trillion total to date, right? Something like that. I've read that before. Crazy.
So that's it. I've got a new booklet out.
Is that the picture book?
It's on a 60-page booklet. Yeah.
Well, on the page we're looking at, you have the Hitler photo album. That's not it. That's another book.
Right.
Now that you might tell us about
available.
That before we move on.
If you go to the website realnewsandhistory.com and you look at the book section, you can see all the books are available there. And yes, the Hitler photo album is there, and there's just some amazing pictures in there that you just don't see in the history books. Why? because they only want us to see pictures of like Hitler giving a speech and he's, you know, yelling, but they don't show the children and with the animals. Yeah.
No, no. Here, you just said something interesting. Many of you have seen movies of Hitler giving speeches, and he sounds like a mad Mickey Mouse, a madman. They don't tell you that the audio was speeded up on those. That's not his normal speaking voice at all, either in conversation or giving a presentation. They made him sound nutty. That's just part of the game. You know all this, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, the other thing they don't tell you, the main thing, is what is he saying? So unless you understand German, you don't know what he's saying. But then when you put the text to the speech, you will find some of the most logical, lucid, compelling arguments that he's making about how the world is run and the injustices being inflicted upon Germany, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody can refute it. So they'll just show you a few clips of him, you know, apparently yelling. But, of course, that was also the style of speaking in those days. You know, you waved your arms and you yelled. But if you really want all of his speeches, they're really profound. There's no platitudes in them, you know. There's nothing in there that's just cliche and idiotic. All of them, they really strike hard because of the incisive logic. That's the way his mind works. So they never tell you what he said. They just show you a few clips of him saying it passionately and make you, you know, try to make you think he's nuts.
Well, I read a very interesting story about that and how the audio was played with in terms of the speed it was run. They just ramped it up.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. So, Mike, where are we today in terms of, this is kind of a fun thing. I used to read those Signal magazines. Signal came out of, they were English language magazines produced in Germany during the war for the English audience. And there was one that I remember very clearly, and it was forecasting what Europe was facing if Germany were to lose the war. You probably remember reading that article, and it was 100% correct. It forecast the future. They could see where it was going.
Well, I mean, one of my books is, it's not really my book. I did annotations on it, commentary on it. I took the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which was discovered right around the turn of the century, 19th century, around 1900 or so. And I just kind of went through each of the protocols and made a parallel to the modern day, explained a few things that added pictures to really help people come up the learning curve. This Protocols of Learned Elders of Zion, you'll find it at realnewsandhistory.com. But, you know, if you have that, that is the Rosetta Stone. Okay, so if you had that in your possession, you knew what World War II was about even back then and what was going to come out of it. Because it says, this is remarkable, Jeff, think about it, this is written in 1900. This is about 15 years before the World War I and 40 years before World War II. It's talking about getting nations into groups and getting them to fight each other in they use the term universal wars, which the United States would be involved with. And we hadn't even fought. We'd never fought a foreign war up until that time. And here you have the Protocols of Zion talking about the United States being drawn into a world war. And so there it is. So it's not because the unknown authors of this document had a crystal ball or anything like that. They had the playbook. And that's what World War II was about. Out of World War II came the framework, what Churchill himself later described as the skeletal structure of world government. Those are his exact words. So, you know, once you understand that, everything else makes sense. Like I said, that's the Rosetta Stone, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion.
You can do something here. Let me do this. I found a recording. There was a meeting between Hitler and Mannerheim in Norway, I believe. And Hitler's bodyguards were very careful about allowing any recording of him to be made at all. But they had a recording going on for this particular speech in the car, in the train car, I guess, and they let it run. Anyway, they caught, I don't know how many minutes of his voice, but it's very interesting. I'm going to play this, and I'll bet no one out there, virtually no one, unless you've heard this clip, will believe that this was the man's real speaking voice. You'll hear two people talking. One is Hitler, and one is Mannerheim. And so here we go. Let's listen. This is interesting. Okay.
Sehr große Gefahr, vielleicht die schwerste. Der ganze Unternehmer hat das jetzt verlassen können. Wir wussten das selber.
They're moving into the car.
Im Winterkrieg hätten wir das nicht, ja, natürlich hatten wir einen Eindruck, dass sie gut gerüstet waren.
That's Mannerheim.
So, wie sie. Right. Wirklich. Und jetzt ist ihm gar kein Zweifel, was sie hatten in ihren Schild.
Ganz klar. Sie haben die ungeheuerste Rüstung, die...
That's Hitler.
Also, wenn mir jemand gesagt hätte, dass ein Stab mit... Wenn mir jemand gesagt hätte, dass ein Stab mit 35.000 Punks antreten kann, dann hätte ich gesagt, sie sind Wahnsinn. 35,000.
Hitler's talking about tanks and that the Soviets were building tanks so fast he couldn't believe it. And he says, we have destroyed right now more than 34,000 tanks. If someone had told me this before, I'd have said, you crazy. If you're one of my generals and had stated that any nation has 35,000 tanks, I'd have said, you, my good sir, you see everything twice or 10 times over. You're crazy. You see ghosts. Yeah. That's what he's saying right here. Yeah. Take a listen.
1,000 Panzer vernichtet. Wenn mir das jemand gesagt hätte, ich hätte gesagt, wenn mir ein General von mir erklärt hätte, dass hier ein Stab 35,000 Panzer in dieser Ziel, Herr, Sie sehen alles doppelt oder zehnfach. Das ist Wahnsinn, Sie sind Gespenster. Das haben wir nicht für möglich. Wenn wir vorher sind, wir haben Fabriken gefunden. Allein eine da in Kramarowskaja zum Beispiel. Das war vor 2 Jahren ein paar hundert. Wir hatten keine Ahnung. Heute ist dort eine Panzerfabrik, die in der ersten Schicht etwas über 30.000 und in den Vollausbau über 60.000 Arbeiter beschäftigt. So eine einzige Panzerfabrik. Wir haben sie besetzt. Eine gigantische Fabrik.
Okay, does that sound like a screaming madman? No. That's the real voice, and there's only one or two recordings existing of that real voice. He also said, he's talking about Ukraine, believe it or not. Ukraine, of course, was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, and they were building tanks there in Donetsk, and Kramatorsk. They had huge plants. He said, today there is a tank plant where, during the first shift, a little more than 30,000, and around the clock, a little more than 60,000 workers have labored during a single day in one single tank plant. It's a gigantic factory, masses of workers who certainly lived like animals, and blah, blah, blah. And then he was interrupted at that point. But you hear him say 30,000 panzers. That's what they call tanks, panzers. But that's true. The Germans literally could not destroy the tanks, the planes, and the personnel that the Soviets threw at them in human wave assaults. They couldn't remove them fast enough from the battlefield. They just couldn't. They were outnumbered, outproduced. And never mind the brilliance and technology, but that's all true. So there's his real voice.
Well, I believe he was speaking about the initial that's what they destroyed in the initial invasion, Barbarossa. Which
that's correct.
The question,
he said we have destroyed 30,000
tanks. Doing there? Yeah,
that's right.
So that is evidence. I mean, there's no question that had he not acted preemptively. The Bolsheviks would have put that force into motion and it would have been unstoppable. It would have.
They would have gone right to the English Channel. It would have been over.
Yeah.
Europe wouldn't have been done.
Yeah.
So no, Hitler didn't start World War II, and he had to invade.
And you know what's interesting,
study your
Jeff,
history. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, I was just going to say, the fake historians like to say that Hitler's claim that he had to strike the Soviet Union preemptively was just a phony pretext. It's a lie.
No, that's true.
Well, that's 1940.
He had to.
No, I know, but they say it's a lie, right?
Yeah.
But
then
in the next breath, they glorify NATO, which was formed in 1948, just 7 years later. For what purpose? To keep the Soviets out of the Soviet Union. So you see how conveniently they can just switch it on and off? When Hitler said the Soviets are coming, oh, no, that's not true. Hitler's lying. But then they formed NATO 7 years later specifically for that purpose, to keep the Soviets out. So there's no question he saved all of Europe from the Soviet invasion.
And cultural and social annihilation.
Yeah. Of course, Europe later went that route anyway on the installment plan through democratic socialism, you know.
They did.
And it's just funny how history turns out, because now Russia is comparatively free and they're rejecting and cleansing themselves of all this degeneracy and Western filth. So it's just weird how the roles reversed, you know.
I couldn't agree more. It's true.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Let me go back and look at this the photo album book. Tell us a little bit more about that one, if you would. That looks like a very intriguing one, full of historic photos of Adolf Hitler you'll never see, except in this book. Tell us more.
Yeah, I had to dig them out, and they're even harder to find now on Google, because Google's just really gotten...
Oh, I know.
They've gotten George Orwell, you know.
Things true.
Going down the memory hole. Sometimes I'll go to Yandex.com,
right,
which is the Russian version of Google, and you'll find much more stuff there. But that's why I meticulously pulled out a lot of those images, and I wanted to show in this book, it's a hardcover, small photo album, you know, images of the Hitler that we were never allowed to see, and it's broken down into sections. Hitler with women, okay? I tell you, these women are going hysterical like it was Elvis, like that, you know? Hitler with children. And these weren't propaganda photos either. You don't fake that. This is all real. Quite a number of them came from people in his own inner circle. These images were not even discovered. These videos and pictures until after the war. Ava Brown was always taking videos. So, you know, you can't say, oh, this is just staged
movies
for the public.
Yeah.
But
right,
it's all real. You see him with the children, how much the children love him, and how much he loves the children, with the women, with the animals, you know, with and amongst his people. And you go through this photo album, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. You know, there's a couple hundred thousand words worth of pictures in that photo album. And it really makes it clear how appreciated and loved he was by everyone in Germany. And it also shows what a soul he has, a good soul that he has. You see him with the children and with the animals, which I've always said is really a good indicator. The way children react to you, the way animals react to you, and even women, it tells a lot, okay?
He is the most dehumanized figure in modern recorded history. The amount of effort that has been put into making that man into a monster is just over the top crazy. And to find the reality of it is more than illuminating about who's controlling the planet. You just got to look at it straight away. And it's a fact. Yeah, Germany, the first country in the world to declare war on cancer formally, to outlaw or try to outlaw cigarettes, cigarette smoking, to outlaw vivisection of animals. That was the scientific experimentation on animals with no anesthesia, etc., and the promotion of vegetarianism. I mean, if this country had done that, it would be talked about to this day, but it didn't.
Yeah, it was an extremely humane leader, and he resisted bombing London as long as he possibly could. German civilian areas were hit.
And to going into Poland. He didn't want to go into Poland. Yeah. He had to.
Yeah.
Because thousands and thousands of Germans were being butchered there. That was that World War One horror called the Treaty of Versailles, which gave part of Germany and Germans to the Polish, and they were killing the Germans. By their photos of this, lots of them. How much is the book, the little photo album book? 120
the Hitler
pages?
Photo album book is $35. It's a hardcover, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And I guess it's about 70 or so pages full of pictures, and it's done on like a cream-colored paper, and each image has like a picture. It looks like an old photo. So, you know, it looks like you're flipping through a photo album.
I'm going to get one.
You know, that's available
a real
at realnewsandhistory.com. Just go to the books section. It's available in books, and things are also available in PDF format as well. But that's definitely one people should have for their, collection. And I tell you, they really get upset. That book was banned. Before I was banned completely from Amazon, they started picking off my books one at a time. The first one was The Bad War, to which you wrote the foreword, actually, if you recall. We're going way back.
Yes, I do. Very honored,
And later on, they went after the Hitler photo album, which is interesting because I don't write much in there at all, just a couple comments and some captions. Okay, so you can't say I wrote hate speech or anything like that. It's just pictures, and the usual suspects got to Amazon, put the screws to them, and I'm like, well, you're taking down a book because it has historical pictures that you don't like. I didn't even put a word in there. I didn't even use the J word or anything like that. You know?
No.
So that really tells you something. You know?
Sure it does. All right, I'm definitely going to get the photo album. I've got The Bad War, which is a must-have also. If you want to really understand, in a nutshell, World War II, it's right there. Mike's got it under control. Now, The British Mad Dog. This one I don't have, and I don't know too much about it. This is about that psychopath Churchill. And I know there may be some of you listening in England right now who are still of a mind that he was a saint. No. It's just not true. Tell us a little bit more about Churchill, if you would, and this book.
Well, I'll tell you, Jeff, when you say psychopath, that's not hyperbole, okay? That's a diagnosis. and you read The British Mad Dog, and you'll see. And it goes way back to his childhood. I mean, things were screwed up for him from an early age, and he just grew up into this person who just had to... His ambition was insane, okay, because he's covering up for insecurities, deep insecurities. And this ambition led him to be a warmonger, also led him to his own personal ruin. Okay, this is a guy who on both sides of his family, the father and the mother, came from wealth. And by the 1920s, he's on his ass. He's broke. His lifestyle was like, you know, you read about these NFL or these NBA players who have these long careers, multi-million-dollar contracts, and then they end up poor, right? Well, that was Churchill. So he's got this crazy ambition, but now he's lost everything. I even got a picture in that book of him sitting. He's got a hot tub at his estate, and it's empty. And he's sitting in there in a lounge chair talking to someone. They're sitting in lounge chairs in an empty hot tub. Uh-huh. We learned from the great British historian David Irving that he couldn't afford to keep the heat anymore. So now you have a guy who
bailed him out twice.
Well, He was
as far
burned.
As we know.
The usual suspects.
Bernard Baruch.
One of them being Bernard Baruch, the infamous Bernard Baruch, who you recall, FDR's son-in-law, said of him once that in 1912 he used to bring Woodrow Wilson around New York City, introducing him to the powerful people of the Democrat Party, leading him like one would a poodle on a string. He owned Woodrow Wilson. He also owned Churchill, and he owned George Marshall, and he owned Eisenhower, going back to the 20s. That's how these guys became the heads of the military. FDR, I mean, he was like the George Soros of his day, only squared. George Soros squares. That's how powerful Bernard Baruch was. And he was one of Churchill's big benefactors. But there were others, and they were all immensely wealthy Jews. The Rothschilds got their hooks in them. Henry Straycosh, you can look up these names. So they took this penniless, I mean, this zero net worth bum who squandered everything, who screwed up everything he touched going back to World War I when he was Lord of the Admiralty, and they picked him up, they dusted him off, and they owned him. They owned him, and he delivered that war to them. It's just a sad story. I mean, to see this guy puffed up into legendary status like he is. I mean, he was just a vile, psychopathic, alcoholic, spendaholic criminal. He was a forger. He used to take paintings that belonged to someone else, and then, although he would make his own paintings, okay, like an abstract painting that anybody could make, and he would put the name of a well-known artist who was dead, and then sell it as his paintings. David Irving uncovered all of this. Total degenerate. So they came to him, hey, you want to be a famous historic world leader? Okay, that's in that condition. He jumped all over the opportunity, and he was their total slave. They even gave him a personal handler, Professor Lindemann from Germany, a German Jew, who was the architect of the firebombings and the carpet bombings of German civilian neighborhoods. Frederick Lindemann, always at Churchill's side.
Wow.
But there's so much to tell about this monster. He truly was a mad dog, and it's all in the British mad dog.
If you look also on Mike King's page, realnewsandhistory.com, look under books and just go down and read the titles to give you an idea. These are books that are all worth reading and all worth considering. You can't find the real, unvarnished, honest evaluation of history like you can in Mike's books. That's why he's banned. There's nothing outrageous in the books, it's just the truth, but they won't have it. And you go on, you got a book on Joe McCarthy, which is another very interesting and completely smeared, if not destroyed, American patriot, Senator Joe McCarthy. You call him St. Joseph of Wisconsin, and that's not a stretch. And you've got some really great books here.
A very brave man.
Oh,
yeah.
One of the best. Did they kill him in Bethesda, you think?
I believe so. I mean, he's only 47 years old when he dies, okay?
Right.
And then came the smear. Oh, he was an alcoholic. He drank his liver out. I mean, really?
Right.
Do we know that? Anyone do an autopsy?
No.
And then there's people close to him and say, well, then he was a social drinker. He wasn't no drunkard, you know? So it doesn't add up. I mean, that's awfully young to die. The guy was healthy, vibrant, 47.
Well, look, threw Forrestal out of a window. They kill people. That's what they do.
Right. And Forrestal was like, you could say he was his mentor, because McCarthy, as a rookie senator, got schooled by Forrestal. And Forrestal was telling him about all this stuff. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, you had three prominent Irish Catholic patriots in that era. Okay? And you tell me what they all have in common, Jeff. This is a really hard question. James Forrestal, Joe McCarthy,
and
John F. Kennedy.
John Kennedy. That's it.
Yeah. And within a period of, 12 years, they're all gone. Okay?
Correct.
So And then they got Bobby Kennedy. Because the Kennedys, although the Kennedys were Democrats, they were anti-communist and they were anti-globalist, they were never part of that network of Northeastern Anglo-Jewish conspirators, you know? The rest of the Kennedys, they went bad, right? But Bobby and John, and as a matter of fact, how many people know this, that RFK's daughter, Carolyn Kennedy Townsend, okay, you know who her godfather is? Mm-hmm. Joe McCarthy is her godfather. Yeah.
Wow.
So,
she's still alive?
I think so, yeah. She ran for Senate in Maryland like 20 years ago. I think she's still alive, you know. And the only Democrat senator who did not vote to censure McCarthy was John F. Kennedy. He called out sick that day of the vote. So, you know, he played it politically. So, and Eleanor Roosevelt was really critical of JFK because he would not take a position on Joe McCarthy, you know, and she wanted to condemn because she was a communist, you know.
Oh, yes. So, died in the wool. The FDR was surrounded by communists. If, in fact, he wasn't leaning that way already, I don't know. But Harry Hopkins, and you can go down the list. He was completely penetrated by communism. You got so many great books. You might want to do a book on Joseph P. Kennedy one day. He had the vision for America, a good vision. He was quite a patriot,
too. I've done some lengthy articles on him.
Uh-huh.
And it's important because if you understand Joseph P. Kennedy, the patriarch, and what he was for, what he tried to do, and what he was against, you understand why all his kids ended up, or half of his kids ended up dead, and even his grandson, JFK Jr., ended up dead. You know, one of his daughters went down in a plane crash. So you had Joe Jr. goes down in a plane accident in World War II. It was not combat related; just blew up in midair. Okay,
right. He's a bomb.
And then you
on
have
board.
Yeah, of course. And the leader of that squadron was FDR's son. How interesting.
Oh, no.
Elliot Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And he's the one from whom we get the official story of that event, of the plane just spontaneously blowing
up. Very interesting.
They hated Papa Joe because he was going to go on his own and meet with Hitler to try to avert the war in Europe that was brewing. And then he was not able to prevent World War II, he wanted to make sure the United States did not get involved, and then eventually FDR replaced him. So they hated Papa Joe, and they knew that he had this burning ambition to have his sons as presidents. So his sons all start dying. Teddy Kennedy, who should not be confused with John and Bobby because he was a degenerate, nonetheless, Ted Kennedy went down in a fatal plane crash in 1962, which killed two people, but he survived.
Right. Wasn't supposed to.
I mean, how many plane crashes? Right. How many? It's statistically impossible.
John Kennedy Jr., John was murdered as clear as we're talking right now. I mean, that's a given. I mean, since when does the U.S. military come in and cordon off an entire crash area of a private plane? They blew the tail off. I had a guy on the program. He was a journalist back there, some small paper, and he was on the beach that night and saw the flash of explosion, which blew the tail off of John Kennedy Jr.'s plane, and he saw it, and it went down, and he was he disappeared shortly thereafter. You know, don't talk about this anymore, that kind of thing.
Right.
So they saw the flash and heard the report. You know, it was a little bit of a delay because it was out over the ocean a ways, but he heard it. Now we got RFK Jr., who, need I say much more than has admitted to flying on Jeffrey Epstein's private jet twice? Do I have to say any more about how independent he is? He is controlled. They're compromised.
Yeah. Well, the Kennedy family went downhill after, Bobby. I mean,
Bobby, that was
after Johnny and Bobby.
Right.
Yeah, that was the end
imagine
of it.
The grief
up until that time.
Imagine the grief that Joseph P. Kennedy and Rose had to live with, knowing that their family was being destroyed before their eyes. It's a horrible thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, that's the story of our history, and there's just so many more. You know, even in the new booklet that I have out, I go into the 19th century. There was a bunch of presidents who died of tummy aches. All of a sudden, they got tummy aches and fever and died. And you know, the history books just mentioned that they died in office. But, you know, historically, the preferred method of assassination, I've always believed, has been poison. It's a lot easier to do that. You know, you got to get a lone gunman who's willing to throw his life away.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, but it's remarkable. Anytime a president has died in office, and we've had four of them, and we've had a couple who got really sick, you know, no one ever stops to at least consider the possibility, you know, was he poisoned? They all had the classic symptoms.
Right.
So,
well, even if they did competent autopsies back in the day with toxicology work, which they didn't, they could all be corrupted easily with one phone call or a direct message.
Well, Warren Harding died suddenly in office, and this is 1923, so by that time they certainly had that capability, but they never did an autopsy. It was just a rush to burial.
That's
you know?
Right.
And Harding was one of the, as a senator, killed the League of Nations, or he blocked the U.S. entry into the League of Nations, you know? So he was an America first there, and he died in office. So you had a lot of this stuff going on.
You got another very interesting book I would really love to sit back and read. When Eisenhower was in office and running for re-election and so forth, and they had bumper stickers back in the day, and they were, the phrase was, "I like Ike." Well, Mike's put together a book with the truth about that evil man. It's called "I Don't Like Ike." And I'd really like to read this one. I mean, I just think of those horrible outdoor Holocaust barbed wire enclosures that he oversaw the mass murder of over a million German military after the war. It's the best guess we can come up with. Not a good man. I will say, and I've said it always, his warning about the military-industrial complex, maybe his guilt was starting to seep through in the end, but that was an excellent speech as far as I can tell. It was a correct warning. And you've got Roosevelt, too. Teddy the Terrible Roosevelt is another one. He's a fake historical figure. He's a real person, but no, this has all been carefully managed, all of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, when they want to, I use a rule of thumb, okay? I always say, if you haven't got the time or the inclination to really research into somebody, a historical figure, I call it Mike's rule of reversal. Anyone who's being puffed up to rock star status, just flip it around, you know he's a villain. Conversely, anyone who's being demonized, okay, flip that around, and he's either a saint or at least a pretty good guy who's just kind of resisting the one-worlders, the globalists, the Jewish cabal.
Right.
So you just kind of reverse things, and you get to the truth. That's how bad it is. Everything's an inversion. So if something is built up, either an individual or an institution, like the UN or NATO, it's bad. And if something is denigrated, vilified, it's good. So, you know,
well,
if somebody's
done
too lazy to really get into it, just go by that, and you'll be pretty okay 95% of the time.
There's another book in your library. It's called Libtard Savant, The Strange Paradox of the High IQ Liberal, in quotes. And it's good. Looks like another good read. You've got these people nailed.
Yeah, that's
just
right, that's like a little booklet, actually. And you know, the premise is you have so many academically, intellectually high IQ accomplished people who they got that way because they were trained from an early age to just repeat everything in the book, everything the teacher says, process this immense amount of information, give it back to the teacher in the form of a test. You get your A, and you get promoted, and you go to good university, you get a good job. The problem with that is you know, you're not necessarily thinking outside the box or thinking critically. So, yeah, you can process, you know, things like math and physics, which is you pretty much have to memorize the basic principles, you know. But, like, when you take that attitude towards things like economics or history or philosophy, you can get brainwashed because you're just believing everything the book or your professor says. So that's why you have people who are simultaneously high IQ yet dumb as hell at the same time.
You got it. Well said. Yeah. All right. Mike King's website, again, is Real News and History. RealNewsAndHistory.com. Some remarkable books there. And I'm going to pick myself a couple up here.
Yeah. Sign up for the mailing list. Free mailing list and a free report.
Thank you, Mike. Good to talk with you again.
Jeff, keep always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. God bless you. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Same to you, Mike. Okay. All right, really an independent researcher of the highest caliber. Okay, gang, back with you tomorrow night on Friday as we move deeper into the holiday season. And I hope there's a little joy out there for each and every one of you at some point. Talk tomorrow. Take care.